But this morning, as our meditation for our prayer meeting, we've been going through, by the way, that shouldn't be the sixth commandment, because it's thou shalt not covet is definitely not the sixth commandment. That should be the tenth commandment. My apologies. But as our meditation, what we've been doing is going through the commandments and looking at them from the four perspectives of what does it teach us, what does it tell us that we are to do, what does it tell us that we are to believe, and what does it tell us about heaven and God. And so the last of the commandments is, you shall not covet. It is this particular commandment that the Apostle Paul says slew him. That is, that it afflicted his conscience. It bothered him. As he looked at his life before he came to faith in Christ and before Christ appeared to him on the road to Damascus, Paul gives us some glimpses of the things that he went through in his life. And he, for example, is very proud of his heritage. He's very proud of his religion. He's very proud of his accomplishments. And regarding the law, at one point he says, regarding the law, he said, I was blameless. That's a pretty arrogant statement to make. And yet that's the way the Apostle Paul saw himself. Until we get to this, thou shalt not covet, or you will not desire, literally in the Hebrew. And the Apostle Paul realizes that this is the one that changes his understanding of the law. Because it doesn't just teach us that it's wrong to be greedy or materialistic. It does that. But it puts a light on all of the other commandments as well. You will not kill. You will not desire to kill. You will not commit adultery. You will not covet to commit adultery. And so it places the realm of sin not just in the action or in the hand or in the doing, but in the heart, the desiring. And that's where sin begins. So let's look at this concept of this commandment. You will not covet. You will not desire. And what does it teach us? This is our first section. Well, first of all, it teaches us that God is our creator and king and is sovereign over everything, including what we own or possess. If what we own or what we have or possess is strictly a matter of our own doing, and in a sense, what we accumulate is a function of our going out and taking it and getting it, then this commandment actually would be detrimental to the human race. But the perspective of Scripture is different. That God can command us not to covet tells us something about God Himself. It tells us that He is the one who allocates to everybody our life. You don't fill out a form before you're born that says, I want these parents. I want these color eyes. I want to be so tall. I want to wind up being this smart or this not smart, depending on which you prefer. I want to be this successful. We don't get to choose our life, our parents, our upbringing. We don't get to choose the influences on us, the teachers that we have. We don't get to choose what country we're born in. All of that is disposed and included in God's sovereign plan. So God gives us our possessions, and He allocates to each of us according to His providence. This is why He can say, don't covet. Because God providentially directs our lives so that to covet is, in essence, to say, God, you don't know what you're doing. I can do it better than you. Get out of my way and let me decide how I should have been raised, what physical qualities I should have, what intellectual capacity I should have, how rich I should be, how accomplished I should be. God, I want something else than what you have decided for me, and I can do it better than you. Coveting is disagreeing with God over His decisions. So knowing this as the background of this law, what are we to do? Well, we are never to look at our life and wish we had someone else's life instead. One, their life really isn't better than yours. But two, it is fundamentally a disagreement with God's wisdom. God obviously does not know everything, and obviously I know more than he does. We are to never look at our possessions and wish we had someone else's possessions. And that could be not just material possessions, but their status in life. The flip side of all of this is what we find written in the New Testament. We are to be content with the things as we have them. Paul in Philippians 4 says, I have abounded and I have been in deep lack. I've been humbled, I've been abased, I've been exalted. Whatever state I'm in, I've learned to be content. And I can do that, he says, through Christ who strengthens me. I have learned to be content in everything. 1 Timothy 6:8 is the harshest one, the most stark statement. Having food and clothing, let us therewith be content. It's written in the context that says that the Christians should not strive or make it their life's goal to be rich. Because those who strive for riches as their priority pierce themselves through with many sorrows. So, what's the corollary? Well, what do you have? What's your station in life? Okay, be content with that. Now, this, of course, is not an excuse for lackluster, laziness. It's not an excuse for God gave me this level of education, I'm not going to get any more. It's not an excuse for not being industrious or working hard. It is a correction to the attitude behind it and the motivation for it. So consider the effect of coveting on your own peace of mind. If your life is primarily one of discontent over what God has given you, what does that do to your peace of mind? Is life ever settled? Are you ever happy? Are you ever thankful? What does coveting do to your money? You're watching the television and the advertisement flips across the screen and you go, ooh, I want one of those. And why do advertisers spend millions of dollars for advertisements? Because it works. They appeal primarily to your coveting, your discontent. You won't be happy until you have one of these. Or you live here, or whatever the case may be. Until you look like this, and buy our makeup, or have your hair cut at our place, not a concern for me anymore, or until you buy one of our products, you just aren't going to be satisfied. But oh, if you buy one of ours, it'll be like living on a tropical island all your life. It'll just be wonderful. It destroys our money because it puts us in debt. We accumulate stuff out of simple covetousness. What does coveting do to your marriage? It's interesting that in the 10th commandment in the book of Exodus, one of the things God specifically mentions about coveting is that you are not to covet your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's husband. Boy, I wish I was married to him, or I wish I was married to her. Discontentment in marriage never, never ends well. Our own economy, even our churches, focus more and more on the concept of being discontent. Churches are advertised. Come here. Why? Because we have more than the other church. You shouldn't be going to that little common church. You should be coming here. Why? Because we have dynamic sermons. Kids like coming to our church. We've got all the lights and the shows. We've got programs. We've got activities. Our sermons are short. Our music is loud. Come here. It's exciting. It's wonderful. We're better than the other guy down the road, the other church down the road. We're bigger. We're flashier. We're more modern. We're more up to date. We're hip. And if you think that doesn't wear on ministers, after all, ministers are never discontent.
You're not talking about us.
No, I'm talking about other ministers. Oh, I wish I had that church. I wish I pastored those people. I wish I could have that kind of recognition. When I was in seminary, Reformed churches are a little different. Our attendance usually exceeds our membership rate. And I don't know if you know this or not, but in the Southern Baptist circles, it's completely opposite, and in fact, exaggerated opposite. Membership is everybody who's ever joined your church in the last 5,000 years. Doesn't matter where they are. That's membership. And so people talk about 10,000 member churches, but generally on any given Sunday, it's about a tenth of that that shows up.
And most of those 10,000 are already.
Yeah, probably so. And with the Lord or not, as the case may be. So one day someone asked me about the church I pastored and how many people you have in attendance. I said, well, we run about 250 right now. Wow! You've got a 2,000, 3,000 member church. And I corrected them. No. We're a Reformed church. We run 250. That's everybody in nursery and whatever. Of course, they're not members because they're not old enough. You know, we have about 120 members right now. And they couldn't fathom that. But there for a short while, when they said, wow, you've got a 2,000 to 3,000 member church, part of me goes, yeah, I do. And so if Pastor X over here has found the solution to make the church grow, then every pastor on the face of the planet is going to now imitate Pastor X because they want their church to grow. And in the end, thou shalt not covet applies to churches just as much as it does to our marriage or our economy or our debt or anything else. So what are we to believe? How are we to pray? Well, ultimately speaking, our prayers don't start with, God, please help me to be content with what I have. Ultimately, it starts with, God, teach me to love and be pleased with you. Help me to find my rest in God. If you say to yourself, oh God, please teach me to be satisfied with what I have, without doing the other first, it will be very short-lived. We want God to teach us to rest in Him, to be delighted in Him, to look at Him and all that He is and all that He has and say, wow, what a great God. I don't need anything else. Pray that God would deliver us and our children from greed and materialism, that God would have mercy on our nation, because we may very well be the most materialistic and discontent nation in our world today. These are the spiritual battles that your children and grandchildren will face. Finally, our thanksgiving and our praise. Heaven is a place of joy because it's a place of perfect contentment. And that perfect contentment starts because we know God for who He is and we delight in Him. We don't look at, and heaven's not a place where we delight in the sunshine or the birds or the perfectly manicured lawns or the palaces or whatever else we think is going to be there. Heaven ultimately is a place where we see God and we realize so much more about Him and we are just absolutely thrilled forever. We're content and happy with God. May God make us content and happy where we are, in Him, and in His grace.